Welcome to the debate. So, back in July 2026, the former British Home Secretary Suella Braverman made this just staggering public claim. She essentially suggested that Britain's former colonies actually owe Britain a thank you, and, you know, perhaps even a little repayment for things like the roads, the deep water ports, and the democratic institutions that the empire supposedly left behind.
Right. And the response to that was, I mean, explosive, to say the least. You had the Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley stepping in and pointing out the sheer absurdity of asking the descendants of enslaved people to, you know, pay for the very machinery that was used to oppress their ancestors. It's a clash that really cuts right to the nerve of how we understand historical legacy, wealth, and ultimately what is actually owed.
Exactly. And that clash perfectly frames the text we are examining today, which is Dr. Bichara Sahali's essay, The Sacrificed Are Told to Thank the Altar: Colonial Debt Reversal and the Life-Coherent Meaning of Reparations.
Yeah, it's a powerful title.
It really is. And what strikes me most about Sahali's framework is how it just cuts through the political noise. I will be defending the essay's core premise today, which argues that continuing institutions, so modern states, legacy universities, legacy corporations, must accept their historical liabilities just as enthusiastically as they accept inherited wealth, and that the only coherent path forward is what the essay calls life capacity restoration.
And I'll be challenging the mechanics of this framework. I mean, I hear that profound moral clarity, and I completely agree that the idea of a colonial debt owed to the colonizer is a grotesque inversion of reality. But I come at it from a different way. I keep hitting a wall when it comes to the operational reality of this. I want us to look hard at the messy mechanics of untangling centuries-old historical causation, because there's a very real danger that attempting to implement massive, newly minted repertory institutions might just accidentally reproduce the exact administrative dependency the essay wants to abolish.
Well, let's examine how the essay actually addresses that fear, right? Because it starts by dismantling the most common caricature of reparations, which is this idea that it's all about inherited personal guilt.
Right, the whole I didn't own slaves argument.
Exactly. It's not about personal guilt at all. It's fundamentally about institutional continuity. So think about the UK's Emancipation Settlement in the 19th century. Parliament abolished slavery, sure, but they financially compensated the slave owners for their, you know, their lost property.
Yeah, the scale of that payout was massive.
Unprecedented. Meanwhile, the enslaved received absolutely nothing for their stolen freedom or the bodily violence they endured. And they were even subjected to a further period of compulsory apprenticeship. And the key here is that the wealth given to the owners didn't just evaporate. It was transferred into banks, legal courts, family estates, literally the bedrock of modern corporate entities today.
Right.
In fact, the British government took out such a massive loan to pay off those slave owners that the modern British taxpayer was still paying off that specific debt until 2015.
Wow, 2015. But see, that's exactly where I think the friction is. If you're listening to this, you're probably thinking, okay, my ancestors didn't own slaves, and my tax dollars today are funding, you know, green energy or public schools, not 19th century plantations. So how do we justify attaching a specific historical liability to a 21st century taxpayer or a modern university student without it feeling like arbitrary collective punishment?
Because the causal density over 200 years is just staggering. You have the Industrial Revolution, two world wars, the Digital Revolution.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. It's less like a standard corporate acquisition and more like inheriting a massive, sprawling estate.
Okay, an estate. Yeah, so if you inherit a grand 300-year-old manor, you gladly take the priceless art, right? You take the manicured gardens, the prime real estate. But if you find out the foundation is rotting and it's actively sinking into the neighbor's property, you can't just tell the neighbor, well, I wasn't the one who built it, so I'm not paying to fix it. You own the estate, which means you own the rot in the foundation.
That is, I mean, that's a compelling argument.
Institutions do this constantly. A monarchy claims titles from centuries ago. A university boasts about its founding in the 1700s to attract students today. You cannot suddenly claim the line of causation is too blurry only when it comes time to pay the bill.
Sure, but have you considered that inheriting an estate is inheriting a closed system?
What do you mean?
Well, you have a defined property line, right? And a specific, measurable, rotten foundation. Historical colonialism was not a closed system. It was an interlocking web of global trade that fundamentally altered the trajectory of the entire planet. Let's take your estate analogy. What if the inheritors of that estate spent the next 100 years building 10 new wings, a tech startup in the garage, and a modern solar grid using entirely separate funding and labor?
The foundation is still rotting.
Yes, it is. But my concern is that by treating a modern, highly complex nation-state like an estate with a neat list of assets and liabilities, we are vastly oversimplifying history. We are trying to draw a straight line through a hurricane here.
A hurricane?
Yeah, because how do you isolate the specific wealth generated by colonial extraction from the wealth generated by entirely separate domestic technological leaps? If the line of causation is blurred by centuries of intervening economic variables, attaching a specific liability to a modern institution becomes an exercise in guesswork, not justice.
But if we refuse to draw that line just because it's difficult, we accept what Dr. Solly calls the falsified balance sheet.
The falsified balance sheet?
Right. Imperial ledgers meticulously counted the cost of building administrative structures, the courts, the ports, but they entirely omitted the uncompensated labor, the extracted minerals, and the crushed autonomy that actually financed them. And the essay uses two really powerful concepts to describe this structural blindness, Moloch and Mammon.
Right, right. So Moloch representing the ancient system demanding human sacrifice to preserve its own order, and then Mammon representing wealth that's been elevated into a governing value, totally detached from the living systems it was extracted from.
Exactly. And to ground those high-level concepts in historical reality, when the essay talks about Mammon, wealth detached from humanity, think about the fact that British enslavers actually took out life insurance policies on enslaved people.
Oh, God. Yes.
They literally converted human breath, human lives, into a financial derivative on a London ledger. When you can throw a human being overboard, as happened in the Zong massacre, and then successfully file an insurance claim for lost cargo, that is the ultimate falsified balance sheet.
It's horrifying.
The human being is destroyed, but the financial claim lives on in the system. To then turn around, as Braverman did, and present colonial infrastructure as a gift, it's a total moral inversion. Prisoners do not owe the jailer for the cost of building the prison.
I completely agree with the moral premise there. Completely. Exposing the hypocrisy of the colonial debt reversal is vital. But I have serious reservations about utilizing the balance sheet framework itself to find our way out of this.
Why? The essay is critiquing it.
It rightfully critiques that falsified accounting, yes. But then it leans heavily into the language of accounting, doesn't it? Debt, ledgers, liabilities, correcting the account. When you frame reparations as correcting an account, you risk reducing immeasurable qualitative human suffering to a transactional ledger.
How so?
Because you can't put a dollar amount on a suppressed language.
Well, no, of course not.
Right? How do you price broken kinship? How do you put a numerical value on generational trauma or lost political autonomy? By forcing these profound human tragedies into an accounting framework, aren't we risking exactly what the essay warns against? We are turning human sacrifice into a math problem.
I completely agree. And actually, so does Dr. Sahali. A check doesn't fix a suppressed language. That's exactly why this theory abandons the idea of a transactional payout and introduces life capacity restoration.
Okay, break that down.
So if the damage was to a society's ability to sustain itself, the repair has to be about rebuilding that specific capacity. The ledger metaphor is only there to expose the hypocrisy of the colonial narrative, you know, to show that the wealth wasn't generated in a vacuum. It's not there to suggest we just need to cut a check and call it even. It's about moving from mammon, the detached wealth, back to living systems.
Okay, so if the goal is not a transactional payout, but rather this broader concept of restoring the conditions of life, we really have to look very closely at the mechanics of what that actually means on the ground. The essay proposes building repertory commons.
Right. Because colonialism deliberately damaged the capacities through which societies sustain themselves, weakening public health, suppressing scientific institutions, enforcing economic dependency, the reparations must rebuild them. So we are talking about massive regional public health systems in the Caribbean to end dependency on external pharmaceutical markets.
Right.
We're talking about climate-resilient infrastructure to protect against ecological shocks that were intensified by centuries of extraction, and crucially, public interest development banks.
And this is exactly where my practical alarms start ringing loudly.
Why?
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that we can spin up these massive international institutions without them falling into the exact same traps we've seen for decades. I mean, we have seen international aid, IMF loans, and World Bank development funds get swallowed by bureaucratic friction, corruption, or elite capture without materially improving the lives of ordinary citizens at all.
But those are neocolonial institutions. They operate totally differently.
But my fear is that the outcome will be identical. If these repertory commons are initially funded or co-managed by former colonial powers as part of a reparation settlement, how is a repertory common any different from neocolonial foreign aid? You are just building a new layer of unaccountable bureaucracy. We risk expending enormous political capital just to create a modernized form of the exact financial dependency the SA wants to abolish.
I'm just not convinced by that line of reasoning because you are conflating a repertory common with standard foreign aid. And the difference lies entirely in the mechanism of governance.
Okay, explain the difference then.
Look at how something like an IMF structural adjustment program works. The donor country or the Western-backed institution dictates the macroeconomic terms from London or Washington. They tell the receiving country, we will give you this capital, but you must privatize your water supply, cut public health care, and deregulate your labor market. That is dependency.
So how does a repertory common mechanically bypass that?
Through horizontal governance. The essay lays out that a repertory common requires the voting power and administrative control to be vested entirely in local stakeholders, regional scientists, and local municipalities. It structurally locks out foreign veto power. The capital is transferred as a recognized settlement of liability, not as a conditional loan.
So the colonizer just hands over the capital and walks away.
Exactly. For instance, a Caribbean Climate Resilience Fund wouldn't have a board of directors sitting in the global north deciding which seawall gets built in Barbados. The mechanism itself cuts the cord of dependency because the former colonizer has zero administrative authority over the fund once the transfer is made. The guiding rule is, does this form of repair enlarge the capacity of living communities to act for themselves? If a foreign power retains a veto, the answer is no, and it fails the test of a repertory common.
Okay, I understand the theory of locking out foreign vetoes, but you still have to govern that capital locally. Institutions have their own inherent momentum. Who audits this public interest development bank to ensure it isn't replicating predatory lending on a local scale, just, you know, with local elites instead of foreign ones?
Because even institutions born of noble, repertory intentions can become self-serving bureaucracies. We are talking about a massive, unprecedented influx of capital into regional administrative bodies. History tells us that sudden surges of wealth often distort local economies and consolidate political power among those who happen to be sitting on the administrative boards. It is a formidable challenge, I won't deny that, but the essay anticipates this by demanding intergenerational stewardship. A repertory common isn't a slush fund for a sitting government. It functions more like a permanent endowment held in trust for the public. It requires radical transparency and measurable outcomes tied specifically to life capacity metrics, things like lower infant mortality rates or localized energy independence.
Those are great principles, they really are, but they are incredibly difficult to enforce over decades. You are essentially asking to engineer a flawless, corruption-proof administrative apparatus to redistribute historically bound wealth. Human institutions have rarely demonstrated that level of precision and purity.
True, but
my deep concern is that we might expend enormous political will to establish these commons, only to find in 50 years that we've simply created a new class of technocrats who manage the repertory economy while the most marginalized people still lack basic infrastructure. The essay brilliantly diagnoses the historical disease, but its prescribed cure relies heavily on an idealized vision of institutional governance that honestly ignores human fallibility.
But let's look at the alternative.
which is?
The alternative is to look at the inherited underdevelopment, the external vulnerability, and the continuing measurable costs of colonial institutional damage, and simply throw our hands up because building better institutions is hard. The current reality is that many of these nations are already trapped in cycles of unpayable debt to the very financial centers that historically extracted their wealth. The goal of the Reparatory Commons is to shift reparations from a backward-looking transaction, which we both agree doesn't work, into a forward-building program of structural justice.
Right.
It's about giving a region the structural ability to cooperate in food security, energy, and climate adaptation with genuine self-determination. Yes, local governance will be messy, but it will be their mess to manage, not a crisis engineered from a boardroom thousands of miles away.
I don't disagree that self-determination is the ultimate goal, and I think the essay makes a profound contribution by shifting the focus from individual checks to collective capacity. It masterfully destroys the moral inversion that suggests the exploited owe gratitude for the infrastructure of their exploitation.
Exactly.
But I still maintain that untangling the causal threads of a 300-year-old global economic system and building these massive reparatory institutions remain formidable, practical hurdles. The mechanics of historical causation are just too messy to be neatly settled by an endowment, no matter how horizontally governed it is.
I think that tension leaves us with two incredibly vital questions that each perspective must ultimately answer. For your side, the question is fundamentally ethical. How can modern continuing institutions possibly justify retaining the wealth, the property, and the geopolitical prestige born directly of historical injustice if they are allowed to unilaterally declare the corresponding liabilities extinct?
That is a heavy question. And for your side, I'd say the burden is intensely practical. How do you operationalize and measure these reparatory commons in the real world without creating new layers of unaccountable bureaucracy or unwittingly renewing a cycle of administrative dependency under the guise of repair?
Both are incredibly difficult challenges. But reflecting on the essay as a whole, the power of Dr. Sahali's core warning remains undeniable to me. We must never mistake the expenditure of imperial power for generosity. We must never confuse the costs of administering a wrongful system with an investment in the people being wronged. Moloch cannot define sacrifice as development.
Exactly. And as Dr. Sahali so powerfully writes, the sacrificed must never again be told to think the altar.
It brings us right back to where we started. We can no longer accept an accounting system that lists the bricks of the prison as a gift while erasing the lies of the imprisoned. We encourage all our listeners to explore the deep complexities of historical debt, causal liability, and life capacity restoration for themselves in the source material. Thank you for joining us on this rigorous exchange of ideas.